This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Our final speaker for this session is Andrew Lemon. And to say that Andrew takes the history of Australian racing seriously is a bit of an understatement. Having researched and written three detailed volumes over the last past 25 years, which cover the social and political history of racing across the nation from its British origins through to the present time. And a recent article in the journal Sporting Traditions, his third volume, which appeared in 2008, was reviewed by Professor John O'Hara, and he wrote, "Despite the immensity of his task, Lemon has repeated the performance of his much younger self and produced a comprehensive, authoritative and highly readable history of horse racing in the modern era." So it's clearly the main reference work for you if you are interested in the history of racing. That volume shared last year's Australian Society for Sports History Biennial Book Award, and in his role as consultant historian to the Victoria Racing Club, he's been involved in several special projects to commemorate the 150th running of the Melbourne Cup and has been a major contributor to the new book, The Story of the Melbourne Cup. And today he is going to address the topic, the Melbourne Cup, why? Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Louise, and distinguished guests, and ladies and gentlemen, and the Melbourne Cup itself. I always feel a bit overawed by that gold celebrity that seems to follow us around. Yes, I got the shortest topic. Why? This is a question I seem to have spent an adult lifetime trying to answer. Maybe from the day I saw my first cup, Rain Lover, showing the courage of a champion and winning the race for the second time in 1969, tenaciously holding on all the way up the straight with the great weight of 9 stone 7 against the challenge of Allsop, who had 2 stone less. What is the secret of the Melbourne Cup? Why does the race attract a following that other races don't? Is it the real thing, or are we all part of some public relations conspiracy? Well, if so, the conspiracy has been running now for 150 years non-stop. The question why operates at several levels. And believe it or not, I can only begin to answer it in the time we have this morning. Why the Melbourne Cup rather than the Sydney, Adelaide, Brisbane, Hobart or Perth Cup? And why does the race extend its magic to New Zealand and indeed around the world? Why the Melbourne Cup and not some other race, the Australian Derby perhaps, or the Cox Plate or the Golden Slipper? It can't just be a question of prize money. There was a time when the Melbourne Cup was going stride for stride in prize money with the Golden Slipper, a time when the Cox Plate was confidently said to be the greatest horse race in Australia. There was a time when the Doomben 10,000 in Brisbane offered money equal to that of the Melbourne Cup. Yet we're not having a symposium today about the Golden Slipper or the Cox Plate or the Doomben 10,000, and I doubt that we will, for all that I revere their place in the Australian racing history. I think Brian Martin would like a symposium on the Cox Plate. Taking the question further, it can be extended to ask, why did the Melbourne Cup seem to make its way so quickly, so strongly into the Australian spirit, into our sense of national identity? I owe more than one of my historical insights to Rod Fitzroy, who is a great enthusiast for the Melbourne Cup, and it was he who pointed out to me that three poets whom we think of as embodying the Australian identity and who knew a thing or two about Australians' love for horses and the punt, Banjo Paterson, Henry Lawson, C.J. Dennis, these three had not even been born when Archer won the first Melbourne Cup in 1861. "I had the money in me hand," is the lament in one of Dennis's poems. It seems historic now, but he was writing about not backing Spearfelt in 1926, and that's 65 years after Archer. And we think of Dennis now as belonging to that establishment period of Australian culture and identity. But we're always wise after the event, aren't we? We should have backed Viewed in 2008. We knew Bart would pick up his 12th. We should have backed Efficient in 2007. Did we ever see a horse win a better derby than the year before? Sometimes we pick it, but never trust the experts. Think of Banker in 1863. You know, the horse who won in the smallest field ever in a Melbourne Cup, a field of 7, And the expert in the sporting paper Bell's Life named him on the eve of the race as one of only three in the race who didn't have a chance. That Australian preoccupation with the race dates back to its beginnings. The Bell's Life I mentioned had a Sydney version and a Melbourne one, both copying a famous sporting paper in London. It was for Bell's that the great Adam Lindsay Gordon started writing in the early 1860s. Gordon was both a poet and a steeplechase jockey. Galloping rhymes that tried to predict cup winners, also with as little success as the tipsters. Henry Kendall wrote his How We Won the Cup in the 1870s, and here the emphasis was not on the egalitarianism intrinsic to this handicap race, but on the romance, the grit and the pluck, the colour and beauty of racing on the one hand, and the sweaty reality of endeavour on the other. It was a cunning Victorian plan, perhaps, for the Australasian reputation of the race that saw New South Wales win with Archer for the first 2 years. And with John Tate's champion Black the Barb in 66, Demester's Sydney Tim Whiffler in 67. You know, there were two horses called Tim Whiffler in the one race in 67, so they were known as Melbourne Tim and Sydney Tim to help out the non-existent race callers of the day. Sydney Tim won. Tate's horses again in 68, 71, 72. Demester again in 78. So between the two of them, they trained the first nine of the first 18 winners of the Melbourne Cup. All went to Sydney. Victorians were described as gallant losers, and we've been doing it ever since. Now, Adelaide had an early look in with Hertel Fisher's Lantern in 1864. Hertel and his brother C.B. Fisher relocated to Victoria. Tasmanian champions Panic and Strop came so close to winning in the first decade, and the rich island state of Tasmania was represented with the Assyrian and Malua in the 1880s. The first New Zealand bred winner was Martini Henry in 1883, and Carbine was the first New Zealand champion to take the race in 1890. But that was a bit later, and it was the stories of the big bets and the glamour and the drama at Flemington in the first decade or two that instantly spread the fame of the race around the colonies. And it was interesting to hear Chris's description of it, because the gambling was different. Perhaps the one thing that he omitted to mention was there was a lot of pre-post gambling that took place at Kirk's Bazaar and the other places where horse people gathered in the months leading up to the race. So Chris identified the fact that what gets people into the Melbourne Cup is that months of build-up and speculation. The conditions of the race allowed for the entries and then for progressive payments of acceptances. So you entered, you then found out what weight you got, you then paid some more money if you wanted to still be in the race, and a bit later you paid some more money. And all of that went into the pot, but it also built up this excitement and speculation. So there was a group of lugubrious bookmakers and energetic ones who used to hang around Kirk's Bazaar and other places in Bourke Street, and their doings were reported in the other states or the other colonies as well. I've been lucky enough to be part of the team taking this year's trophy for the Emirates Melbourne Cup on its tour around Australasia. And here we have it in Canberra today, still in the early stages of what's become a royal progress. Last week I was with it and with John Letts in Gawler, and then with John Marshall of Rogan Josh fame at Streaky Bay, Port Lincoln, Jamestown and Broken Hill, centres that each have strong connections to the Melbourne Cup story, because wherever you go now there seem to be stories attached in each location to the Melbourne Cup. Streaky for Kieran McAvoy, where most people seem to be related to him, and Brew in 2000. Port Lincoln to those famous ladies, Maureen, Kylie, Belinda, Diane and Vanessa, whose names combined to create the ridiculous name Maccabi Diva. I do remember in 2003 thinking no horse with a stupid name like that could ever win a Melbourne Cup. Now there's a statue of her on the foreshore at Port Lincoln, to which we paid homage, and of course there's one at Flemington as well. You know, in England there's even a statue to a Melbourne Cup place-getter. Persian Punch ran third twice in the Melbourne Cup, but perhaps not for those reasons. There is a statue of him in England as well. Now, Jamestown, where they still race once a year on a generous grass track, Bart Cummings' dad, Jim, had his first registered winner, a horse called Myrtle, this is good for your trivial pursuit, at Jamestown 100 years ago this year. Broken Hill last Monday, because Mick Robins was a Broken Hill boy, he trained Rainlover to those consecutive cup wins, even though Mick only got his trainer's licence months before the first victory. Mick came with us last Monday, just after his 80th birthday, and he got a hero's welcome. And, of course, the jockey of Rain Lover, Jim Johnson, is also one of the ambassadors on this tour. He's also in his 80s. The whip action's not quite as vigorous as it used to be, but the wit's still very good. He's fast with the wit, not the whip. Well, when you show the trophy, when you talk about the Melbourne Cup, interstate rivalries vanish. This is not the VRC's Melbourne Cup. It's not Melbourne's Melbourne Cup. It's Australia's Melbourne Cup. The Loving Cup itself, the trophy that was designed in 1919, has moved around a little bit. Interestingly enough, Peter Pan's trophy that's here in the National Museum, it is the trophy of a hero. It also happens to be the smallest and lightest of all the Melbourne Cup trophies of this design, and yet it's one of our great icons in Australian sport. We don't judge the Melbourne Cup according to the size and the gold content. It's the heart that goes with it. You'll hear some of the stories this afternoon that I think will put real life into the abstractions that I'm talking about today. So my interest in racing history has always combined an admiration for the exploits of the champions with my quest to understand how the whole story unfolded. Maybe I arrived on that racing scene at a special time, because on that Cup Day when Rain Lover won in 1969, the magnificent Crisp won the Cup Day steeplechase, went on to have a distinguished steeplechasing career, nearly won the Grand National in England, and lived to a ripe old age in retirement. And in that same carnival, I think it was the three-year-old champion Vane who was winning the big sprint events. That's right, isn't it, Brian? So it was a pretty amazing sprint carnival in 1969. Little wonder I became fascinated by horse racing in that golden age. And it was also the same year that David Lee Bernstein published his odd, engaging book, The First Tuesday in November, a kind of social history of the Melbourne Cup. And almost by accident, I found myself researching aspects of Australian racing history, and at university, I wrote an honours thesis on the unsuccessful attempts to legalise the tote machine on race courses in Victoria. So that was perhaps prophetic of a future career. Victoria was the last to allow what the bookmakers and the churches, in what was called an unholy alliance, both tried to block, and they called it the infernal machine, to be used at the track. The tote was on other Australian tracks, but it first appeared, as Chris said, at Flemington in 1931, the year that Farlap was beaten in the Cup. So, why the Melbourne Cup? Well, in my first foray into explanation, writing on my first of the three volumes of the history of Australian thoroughbred racing in the 1980s, I found three pieces of alliteration, and I think they still hold up. Geography, gentlemen and gold, to explain why Melbourne racing in general, and the Cup in particular, so quickly dominated the Australian racing scene. And it's certainly true that there have been times in which New South Wales was well ahead of Victoria in terms of prosperity and the success of its racing, but never in front of the Melbourne Cup. Geography meant that Melbourne enjoyed the benefit of being the physical hub not only of the fertile and prosperous colony of Victoria, but also of the Australasian colonies, including New Zealand. Ships and then trains linked Melbourne to the other colonies and every part of Victoria. That helps explain the disproportionately large attendance that Rod Fitzroy noted a moment ago, because people did, as Mark Twain also added, come from far and wide to come to the Cup. There was also the question of climate, which should not lightly be discounted. Melbourne famously has its four seasons, not always on the one day. We are having a real winter this year, the first perhaps for half a decade. Short, grey, wet days, interspersed with brief, brilliant, sunny ones, finally give way to spring, and the grass begins to grow. Melbourne at some time in September and October starts to offer jewel-like days. Horses flourish, humans emerge from hibernation. The focal point becomes the first week in November, even though Melbourne's spring is notoriously treacherous. Shades of Van der Ham in 1976 or Maccabi Diva, a second win, or many of the Melbourne Cups that my wife said I invited her to. Uncomfortably hot days are still rare in the first week of November. They arrive soon afterwards. Flemington is timed to be at its best, and it is a magnificent amphitheatre for horse racing. Well, gentlemen, in my alliteration, refers to the early European settlers in Melbourne, though many of them didn't really deserve the title. But their descendants, actual and spiritual, continued to exert control of Victoria's racing for decades afterwards. land-grabbing larrikins as they might be seen today, these pioneers had prodigious energies and were keen to make quick fortunes from sheep, cattle and land deals. They brought with them the craze for English horse racing, a sport that was spreading throughout the world wherever the English sphere of economic or political power predominated. There were some 20 years between the first use of Flemington as a racecourse in 1840 and the first Melbourne Cup. And in that time, the gentlemen set a pattern of annual and then twice-yearly race meetings, created rules, set up racing clubs, contrived prizes, started betting among themselves on a large scale, and in general, the women in the community, fewer though they were than the men, were not averse to joining in for a day out. There's a brief period in the gold rushes when you get the observation that some of the women didn't think it was safe to come to the races, but generally it's been a sport that's been supported by both sexes in Australia, even though the men had the ruling hand for a long, long time. When the Melbourne Cup did come into existence, there was this infrastructure already in place. So don't think of the first Melbourne Cup as being a totally primitive thing. They had 20 years of experience behind them. People who've heard me speak or write about the early Melbourne racing will know that I put a big emphasis on an event that still barely registers in the folklore of Australian racing. I'm speaking of the Australian or Australasian champion sweepstake at Flemington in 1859, 2 years before the first cup. It attracted the largest crowd ever gathered to that time in Australian history. Some estimates said the crowd was as large as 40,000. You've been told there were 4,000 at the first Melbourne Cup, but this was the ultimate intercolonial challenge grudge race with a big cash prize put up by the Melbourne sportsmen at the peak of the gold rush period and matched by those who travelled their horses to run in the race. It attracted a build-up of speculation in the months before the race, a feature that, of course, would soon attach itself to the cup. They came from Tasmania, Sydney, New Zealand, far parts of Victoria, and the South Australian horses were shipwrecked on a reef off Port Macdonald near Mount Gambier. And one of them, the Barber, swam ashore, was later caught and identified, was walked to Portland, where they wanted to put him on a ship, but for some reason he had other ideas. So they walked him to Geelong, which is as far as the railway from Melbourne came. And he arrived in Melbourne 3 weeks before the race, put back into training and ran in the Australian champion race. So triathlon with a difference, I think. Unfortunately for the fairy tales, he finished eighth, but to my mind, he's a great champion. And having been perhaps one of the persons who ultimately debunked the story of Archer walking to the first Melbourne Cup, we have a grandson of Etienne Demester to speak to you later on today, and I hope he'll corroborate my story. But debunking the story about Archer walking to the first Melbourne Cup, I like to say I can trade. If I ruin a good story, I can give you a better one in exchange. So we'll have to think about what we can do about the Barber. But it's 150 years, 2 years ago, last year, that was the wreck of the Admella was commemorated down in that region. The financial success of that race, the Australian champion race, prompted the Flemington Racecourse trustees, because there was not yet a VRC, to reconfigure the racecourse virtually to the layout we know today. When the land had first been set aside as a racetrack, only the river flats were included in the racecourse reserve. But smart racegoers immediately gravitated to the adjacent hill, which was a natural grandstand. So slowly, land on the hill was added to the racecourse reserve, and in perhaps the most far-sighted move of all, the trustees secured a branch railway from the town centre to the course, which was in place for that first Melbourne Cup in 1861. They shifted grandstand, saddling paddock, finishing straight and winning post to a spot in front of the hill. In the days before big screens, radio and course broadcasts, the natural advantage of Flemington and its hill created the attraction, the unique attraction of this racecourse. So gold in my three G's refers to wealth. Melbourne in its first 15 years had already been a prosperous town with boom and bust cycles, but gold made Melbourne rich in the 3 or 4 decades that followed. The speed with which Melbourne transformed from a pioneer settlement to a metropolis between the 1850s and the end of the 1880s made the city an international phenomenon. An analogy today might be Dubai in the last 30 or 40 years, but Melbourne had natural advantages lacking in the desert. It emerged as a place of cultural depth with its schools, instant university and library, Parliament and cathedrals, telephones, cable tram network, railway system, theatres, restaurants, and all the accoutrements of a big city for better and for worse. And people had to pinch themselves to realise that that settlement was so new. Horse racing, I've found, has been a good economic indicator in Australian history. And all through the 19th century to the end of the land boom of the 1880s, the Melbourne Cup was the showcase for Melbourne's prosperity. Melbourne was able to show off with impunity at the Melbourne Cup. In 1873, a Brisbane journalist said Melbourne was a place in which to make money, and those who make it fastest receive the highest praise. Staid conservative Sydney disapproved of this brash, irreligious city, 50 years its junior, which had so swiftly surpassed Sydney in population and frivolity by the end of the 1880s. Melbourne became a bit sombre after that. Sydney papers condemned the waste of money. I quote, the insane rivalry of the fair sex in matters of dress, the improper risks taken by the men. The danger is that people will wear themselves out by a feverish, unnatural life. And as I say, we've been doing it ever since. When times did go sour in the 1890s, the Cup remained a beacon of hope. Rod Fitzroy gave us the Mark Twain account of Melbourne, and that was describing a city that had at length been savaged by economic depression. The Melbourne Cup always resisted the dampening effects of hard times, even though prize money went down. By the 1900s, Melbourne had a revival as the temporary federal capital, and Cup Week festivities were enlivened by the perks that went with it. For example, not just one governor, but also a governor-general to bring vice-regal retinues to the races. They had to build a separate box for the governor-general. As the satirical Melbourne Punch said in the 1900s, the governor gives a ball, sometimes two balls, and a garden party at Government House. The warships with their plentiful crews of dancing officers make for Hobson's Bay with such regularity that it has become a standing joke in social circles. Beyond the influence of gentlemen, gold and geography, we see some other elements at play in making the reputation of the Cup. First, Australians began looking at the Melbourne Cup as a way of asserting Australian identity, separate from perhaps British identity. The Cup might have had elements in common with Ascot or Derby Day at Epsom, but it was different in its egalitarianism, and Flemington was different in the facilities it offered the racegoer. The English people go fair baloney about Ascot, and several of them said to me, "Have you got anything like this in Australia?" wrote correspondent Jack Cohen from London to the Melbourne racing paper Sportsman in 1898. "I can assure you," said Jack, "it's 1,000 to 1 on Flemington as far as the racecourse is concerned. You can take my word there is only one Flemington in the world." Each year, journalists stretched their ingenuity to write stories about the Cup, but yet the tall tales and true came out to meet them. That famous dream story where Ballarat publican Walter Craig dreamt that his horse Nimblefoot would win the Cup, but that the jockey would be wearing a black armband to honour the dead owner. That dream story came true, but it prompted a nightmare of Cup dream stories to follow. And the bookies used to encourage people to dream the winner of the Melbourne Cup. The father of the Australian Prime Minister, Joe Lyons, in Tasmania, when Joe was possibly not even born, dreamt one night the winner of the 1887 Cup. He sold the family house, took the ship across Bass Strait, went to the Cup and plonked the lot on Tranter, who finished 15th to Dunlop, thus making it possible for Joe Lyons to boast that he grew up in poverty and reached the highest land office in the land. On the other side of the ledger, a struggling dairy farmer near Melbourne discovered on the afternoon of the race in 1902 that he'd drawn the winning ticket in George Adams' Tattersall sweepstake lottery, even though the sweep was illegal in Victoria, but harboured by the Tasmanian government in Hobart. The winner's 9-year-old son, I'm talking about that, the sweep winner's 9-year-old son, Len, never forgot the day. "I was in the kitchen eating a slab of new bread piled with marmalade and cream skimmed from the dishes in the pantry when I heard a crashing noise like part of the house coming down the stairs. And there was Dad holding a slip of paper and shouting, 'I've struck it! I've struck it after all these years!'" In retelling this story in the new story of the Melbourne Cup book, which I'll show in a tick, I go on to add that his father was now able to afford a secondary education for the boy, and Len Stretton ended up as a Supreme Court judge and headed the 1939 Royal Commission into Victoria's bushfires. So the Melbourne Cup changes lives in strange ways. Len also said that his father became more suspicious and tight-fisted as a result of this win. So it's a two-edged sword, horse racing, as perhaps Andrew Peacock had demonstrated so well earlier today. So these stories make an intersection with what Chris McConville was talking about in his paper. Historians will always struggle to understand the full influence of gambling on the shape of Australian racing history because, by definition, much of this influence was either never documented or the documents have never been retained or the studies can't be made. It's really hard to do a study of something that is a shifting industry. Anecdotal evidence of corruption and criminality in racing abounds. It can rarely be tested. Most of it is untrue, but that doesn't mean that all of it is. And what it does tell us is that what people believed or what people said to each other, we know that, and not necessarily what actually happened. So it's a very difficult area to be precise about. Racing has its saints and sinners, often combined in the one person, and it has historically been full of lies and rumours, and I don't imagine that that will ever change. My long researches suggest that the 19th and much of the 20th century, large betting interests exerted huge influence on the promotion of Australian racing. I have no doubt that networks of illegal bookmakers subsidised directly or indirectly many of the numerous publications, such as form guides and racing papers, that boosted the sport. Illegal betting interests, the SP networks as they were known, sponsored radio broadcasts when the wireless came out into the world of racing from the late 1920s. You know those stories of the famous race caller, Ken Howard, being denied access to tracks in Victoria and resorting to ruses to find an off-course vantage point from which to call the races. The roof of a furniture van conveniently bogged outside the track, the veranda of a pub opposite the track, a hot air balloon tethered to the ground. You can be sure that these publicity stunts did not come cheaply, and you can be equally sure that his radio station was not paying the bills in the interest of freedom of speech. Illegal bookmaking interests did all they could to prevent in every state the introduction of what became known as the TAB, the off-course government-sanctioned betting network under the banner of the Totalisator Agency Board. The TABs emerged around Australia from the early 1960s into the 1970s. Tasmania was the last to get one. For what must now seem a golden age in the financing of Australian racing, the TAB might have robbed racecourses of regular crowds, but it did create an effective monopoly of racecourse betting and did funnel regular dividends both to governments and the sport. Then as governments became more greedy, as technology offered a backdoor to other media of gambling, and as private entrepreneurs sought and succeeded in getting a share of the action, those TABs have been privatised and absorbed into a larger betting world in the past 15 years. Racing, as both Chris and Rod mentioned, had an effective monopoly of betting in Australia, but no more. The publicity for racing, for whatever reason, throughout the 20th century was huge, and the Cup was racing's grand final. The fame of the Melbourne Cup owes a huge debt to the showmen of the wireless and in time the television, such as Ken Howard, Bert Bryant, Bill Collins, Joe Brown, our own Brian Martin, Bruce McAvaney, Clem Dimsey, Wayne Wilson had a walk-on role with Media Puzzle, Des Hoisted, and the current champion broadcaster, in my opinion, Greg Miles. And there are part players who've been part of that media enthusiasm, including John Letts, also here today, and you'll hear more from John later this afternoon, who won two cups and now interviews the breathless, emotional winning jockeys in the saddle, and always a highlight of the Melbourne Cup telecast. Yet without any financial motive, the fame of the Melbourne Cup has been kept alive in the hearts of Australians from one generation to another by tradition, sentiment and affection. I think of the man who wrote to me just a couple of weeks ago who said he hadn't missed a cup since standing as a nine-year-old in the wet to watch the grey Hiraji win in 1947, graduating as the years went by as spectator from the flat to the little flat to the hill to the lawn stand and finally to the upper deck of the members' grandstand. Maintaining an unbroken link with his grandfather, who, till the 1950s, saw every cup since Chester won in 1877. That's 133 years of unbroken cups between grandfather and son, and we'd like to hear if anybody else can challenge that record. I think of the people who tell me they have no time for racing, but always have a flutter on the cup. The ones who remember where they were and what they were doing when a particular horse won the cup. I met a woman on the tour in Cloncurry last year who recalled the year Mum scrounged $5 from the jam jar, well hidden from Dad, and plonked it all on the nose of a particular long shot in 1972, disappeared for a week to the coast and came back with what was thereafter known as the Piping Lane Memorial Fridge. I myself possess the At-Talak outdoor furniture setting, now getting slightly the worse for age. The saga of the cup trophies, which in a way is sort of something that Jeff Slattery, who produced this story of the Melbourne Cup book, had the idea to say, let's do a whole section in this book about the trophies, because the story of the trophies themselves, the actual objects, is another gateway into the story of the Melbourne Cup. And if you get a chance to read that section of it, you'll find some extraordinary stories and sagas of the actual trophies. Well, apart from a gesture towards the poets, I haven't even begun to talk about the way in which the cup has shown its significance to Australians in art, in novels, in attempts at non-fiction, in music, in stamps, in coins, as we found today, in the theatre and the movies, however inaccurately, from the black and white movie days to Archer and Farlap and Kenny. You all know that Nicole Kidman was in that Archer movie, don't you? It was one of her first big breakthroughs. Of course, Archer heroically walked to Melbourne, which he didn't. It was ridden by the wrong jockey in the Melbourne Cup, but it doesn't matter, does it? It's folklore. And, of course, as I say, Kenny, the sanatorial plumber, also ends up at the Melbourne Cup carnival. So it's quintessential Australian, and I think that's an example of it there. And, of course, the Melbourne Cup featured in the very first season of the Australian Ballet in 1962, Peggy Van Praagh wanted an Australian theme. Kathleen Gorham, even though she was a girl, played the role of the stallion Archer, so you can do a lot with imagination. And she did it beautifully, I'm told. And nor have I spoken as I would have liked to have spoken about the special bond that Australians historically have had with horses, the actual animals themselves. It is part of the explanation for why we learn to love the cup and maybe why we like the handicap conditions that seem to give the lesser lights a better chance and make the champions really prove themselves. I want finally to say something about integrity. And as Chris has said so well, for periods in the 19th century, the Melbourne Cup, like many races, was plagued by accusations of skullduggery. Trainers such as the hugely successful James Wilson of St Albans prepared their horses in secret and did everything they could to keep the potential of untried youngsters under wraps. But he had a bit of a hotline to Joe Thompson, I think, as well, didn't he? So the famous bookmaker. Accusations flew every year, and attempts have been made, sometimes successfully, to nobble or intimidate horses from Newminster, who'd won the Caulfield Cup. As Chris said, he didn't get to run in the Melbourne Cup in the 1870s, to Farlap, who was shot at days before the race in 1930, to Beauvite, who was similarly targeted in 1940. They actually shot the wrong horse in the case of Beauvite, but the jockey was so spooked by it that the horse didn't run up to form. And, of course, to the favourite in 1969, Big Falloo, who was doped by a crooked ex-strapper at someone else's behest and had to be withdrawn less than an hour before the race. So the Cup and Victorian racing certainly hasn't been immune from scandal and incompetence, but compared with racing in other states, it's generally come out shining. And some credit must go to the people who ran the sport. It is easy to lampoon those old BRC committee men of the 19th and the 20th centuries. I'm not talking about your period, Rod Fitzroy, as rich snobs, out of touch, misogynistic, patronising to jockeys and trainers, wanting to grab privileges for themselves. I've read all of those comments before. And as in all caricatures, there's just a touch of truth. But they shared in a desire always to make not just Flemington and the Melbourne Cup great, but to make Australian racing prosper. Victoria's successive paid or stipendary stewards sometimes made mistakes, but they gave racing in that state a kind of confidence which I think has helped keep it in high esteem. Curiously, many of those chief stipes were of Irish stock from the Warrnambool district. I think they've got a special farm down there where they produce them, thinking of names such as Jim Ahern, Pat Lawler and more latterly, Des Gleeson. And of course, on the committee level, we have men such as L.K.S. MacKinnon in the 1920s, regarded as the villain in the Farlap movie, and in the 1930s, we had Sir Chester Manifold as chairman of the VRC, a great visionary. Sir Chester Manifold could have become a great politician. He went into the Victorian Parliament. He was a mate of Bob Menzies, but he left the Parliament very quickly, saying he couldn't stand the hypocrisy. So that was a call by Sir Chester, and he very much, through his force of his personality, got the first TAB up and running in Victoria, and the others followed. Sir Chester wanted them to be austere places, a bit like a kind of car wash, I think, where you sort of went in to put your bets on. He was determined that they were not going to be betting shops. You know, I can remember going into the Victorian ones, and the races would, the betting would shut 40 minutes before the race. You couldn't get your winnings till the next day, and there were no radio broadcasts allowed. But it was a facility. It was this, like if you had to go, you could go there. But so each of these people leading the VRC have had those motivations, and when you read the comments of their critics and the people who were out to get them, you've also got to look at what their motivation is, what their particular story is. Well, perhaps I've gone on for too long. I should add that you should be confident that the connections of most horses in the Melbourne Cup these days are desperately keen to win. And that's a good betting race to bet on, isn't it? When a champion fails to get up, dark whispers emerge of jockeys on the take. People find it impossible to believe in their hearts that even carrying the grandstand, Farlap should have been beaten in 1931, Rising Fast in 1955 going for the double, or Tullock in 1960. Well, as I said to begin with, I've only opened up the topic with this discussion, but I would like to end by plagiarising myself from the essay that I wrote in the story of the Melbourne Cup. It's called Tracks That Led to the Melbourne Cup, and it might give you a little bit more understanding of those early days, and perhaps it sums up some of my observations of the elements that went into the first Melbourne Cup, which I believe are still current today. So I'll just conclude by reading that short passage. All the pieces were in place for the first Melbourne Cup. In no particular order, these included the race course and the hill, the strategic location of Melbourne as the hub of Victoria, the broad track and the magic of Flemington, road, river and railway, the turf, the long home straight and the vantage points, the racing tradition already in place, the crowds and the sense of occasion, the best horses in the land. The two-mile distance of the race, a true test of the thoroughbred, not too short and not too gruelling. The gentlemen who set the standard, the officials, their rules, the attempts at fairness to all. The jockeys who took the risks, the racing silks. The spirit of frontier men and gold speculators and their eternal willingness to take a gamble, bookmakers to accommodate them gladly. The prize money, the wealth of gold-rich Melbourne, the weight scale, a handicap that gave every horse a hope, but also the champions the chance to prove themselves as such. The anticipation, dreams of the underdog, dreams of glory by owners, trainers, breeders and riders, battles of wits. The appeal to all classes, unfixed though these classes were in a new colony. The governor and the well-dressed women, the travellers from far and wide, the roughs and the swells. The food and the drink, the tents and picnics and sense of holiday. Competitors coming from distant territories, communication to the outside world, press and technology, and above all, the drama of the spring, a theatre ready for the show. Extraordinarily, 150 runnings later, nothing has really changed. On Thursday, the 7th of November, 1861, out of a rudimentary colony, came fully formed the perfect race for Australia. Thank you very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.